From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. All Eyes Tuesday, we're focused on world markets, which saw another wild day, one which opened with more losses in Asia, particularly China, and then turning into an upwards trend across Europe and the U.S. China's key index, the Shanghai Composite, fell another 7.63% Tuesday. That index has fallen 22% since August 19th, its worst four-day rout since 1996. Tokyo's Nikkei index closed 4% down, while other Asian markets managed to recover after Monday's collapse. The Hang Seng closed under 1% higher, while one of the previous worst-performing markets, Taiwan's TSEC 50 index, closed 3.58% up. European markets made a modest recovery Tuesday after what's being called there the Black Monday crash. Markets in London, Germany, and France regained between 2 and 3% in afternoon trading. In fact, at the close of business, all European equity markets were trading in the green. Here in the U.S., markets had a bumpy day, gaining back part of Monday's losses at the opening, with the Dow opening slightly above 16,000, up from Monday's close at 15,874.29. The Dow climbed to 16,312.94 after 11 a.m. Eastern Time, but by press time at 1:40 p.m. had fallen back to 16,096.63. That was down from the high last week of 17,517.19, marking a loss for the week up to that point, totaling 8.1% in value. Uncertainty in China is the explanation being offered by most of Western analysts in the mainstream media, who point to the apparent rebound Tuesday in Europe and the U.S. after China announced it was easing monetary policy to stimulate its domestic economy. China's central bank reportedly cut its interest rates for the fifth time in 9 months. China also increased the amount of money available for lending by reducing the minimum reserves its banks are required to hold by 0.5 percentage points. But Liu Baocheng, director of the Center for International Business Ethics at the University of International Business and Economics in Beijing, said that the set of expectations of China, which other nations hold, needs to be more carefully considered in this interconnected world.
Well, I believe it is a shared responsibility because the world economy is getting so much so interdependent on each other. And of course, the Beijing shared part of the blame because of the contagion. And I think the world had high expectations of China's performance as a driver for the global recovery. And right now, it is not living to the expectation. And particularly, we see that the Chinese PMI is in the contraction range for a couple of months. So the confidence in the stock performance of those companies is still waning. And many of those investors over the past few months have got their fingers burned, and now they are in a heating process, so therefore they are still hesitant to participate in this stock exchange speculation, despite of the efforts and despite of the good incentive that the Chinese government has put into the stock exchange.
Baocheng also pointed out the difference between a crisis, which is systemic in nature, and a crash, which is an event, adding that, while China's real economy is doing fine, some other nations whose economies are fundamentally troubled, like the U.S., might want to look inwards for a solution. Among the structural problems plaguing the U.S. economy in particular are the very high rates of unemployment and underemployment, products of the decades-long transfer of manufacturing jobs out of the U.S. to China and elsewhere, along with the assault on labor in general and unions in particular. Those problems are separate from the trading prices on Wall Street, but they are ultimately related since the declining purchasing power of the vast majority of American consumers does have effects on the incomes and consequently the stock values of the same firms whose stocks are being traded. The U.S. was formerly the most profitable consumer market on Earth, with one of the world's most prosperous working classes sporting a remarkable amount of discretionary income. This drove a massive expansion of productive capacity and supported growing consumption for most of the post-war period from the 1940s until the end of the 1960s. This in turn created great wealth for the owning classes and the development of an international system of finance, the likes of which the world had never known. The productive capacity of U.S. industry, coupled with the country's financial stability, provided the basis upon which the reconstruction of post-war Western Europe and Japan were able to take place. These tools gave the U.S. a tremendous strategic advantage in its Cold War struggle against the Soviet Union, which had suffered huge destruction of its economic assets at the hands of the armies of Nazi Germany. With the huge changes in the global economy since, including rising economic and political multipolarity, some of that strategic advantage has eroded. In times of economic and/or financial uncertainty, this fact could become a source of potentially dangerous geopolitical instability. For more on the strategic implications of the recent financial chaos and the economic troubles at its base, we spoke with Mark Sloboda, Senior Lecturer in International Relations and Security at Moscow State University, via Skype from Moscow, Tuesday. Mark, welcome back, and it's a pleasure to speak with you as always.
Hi, Don. Thanks for having me.
So, you know, there's been all this volatility in the stock markets around the world. The drop again today, Tuesday, in China of almost 7%. The drop on Monday and also last week saw, you know, collapses basically in stock prices, almost 10%, 12% losses aggregated in the past few days in the West generally. Supposedly, it was going to be Russia that was going to have its economy collapsed by U.S. sanctions and dropping oil prices and all of that. And that hasn't happened. What does it look like from Moscow watching this stuff, first of all?
Okay. All right. From my perspective of what's going on, particularly over the last few days, is that it's not in particular a Western problem, but a global problem, another problem with global capitalism, the financial architecture of the world, capital flows west to east and back and forth, basically, you know, the whole architecture of the global neoliberal capitalist system that has not received any significant correction from the faults that led to the correction of the 2008 financial crisis in the U.S. And people have been talking, financial experts have been talking for quite some time now about bubbles in China, okay, that too much easy money, speculative money was invested in China and that some things were overvalued. At the same time, a lot of the growth that has come out of the West, particularly the U.S. and the U.K., since 2008, which it must be said that growth seems to be widely separated from the real economy. Okay, we separate the real economy from the stock markets, from the financial markets, which the two have some connection, but increasingly, not just in the U.S., I would say even more so in China and Russia, are separated from the real economy that most of us live in. What the U.S. and the U.K. were doing to speed up growth at all costs after 2008 was flooding the market with quantitative easing, that is, printing money like mad. And I mean, you can check the quantitative easing percentages in the US and UK. They were both up over 100%. And this was acting like drugs. This was like meth pumped into the global economy that sparked it and jumped it up. But they can't keep doing this forever. And just within the last few months, stopped the quantitative easing and then started talking about raising interest rates. And that led to a lot of the panic that we saw last week that compounded on events in China itself due to some speculative bubbles and some, I think we can say that China not quite immediately deciding what strategy they were going to take. They've settled on letting the markets settle where they were and then cut interest rates. And today, I think we have seen in the last few hours a big surge in response to that the PRC's bank cutting interest rates, which caused a last-minute surge in the Asian markets, and I think we'll see the Western markets rebound today. But to get back to the point, that I think that this is, again, a part of the fact that we haven't seen any significant needed regulation of our stock and financial markets since 2008. That's not only in the U.S. and the U.K., but the whole world, as they are the largest drivers of the global institutions and the global architecture for financial transactions. The onus is really still quite much on them. Specifically from Moscow, what we've seen is, we also saw a drop in the Moscow stock market. Again, the Moscow stock market seems quite separated, I would say even more so than the United States, from the real economy, because so much of the real economy is in people's hands or in state hands. The stock market, Russians are not as widely invested in the stock market, not even in the middle up and the lower upper classes, as are people in the United States. We don't have these huge mutual funds for pensions and so on. So what happens in the Russian stock market? The Russian people take a look at it and they don't really know how much, if any, of an effect changes there, unless really, really drastic, will have an effect on their lives. Certainly not immediately, and maybe not even in the near future. Far more important for the Russians is, at least to some extent, is the drop in the ruble. And this has been, this is a second drop in the ruble. We saw almost a year ago, we saw a big drop in the ruble, and then it recovered within a couple months to recover almost all of its value from the beginning of the sanctions war and the financial crisis in Russia. And it really didn't have that much of an effect, at least not on common, ordinary Russians. In fact, what the Russians who suffered most from this sanctions war have been the richest Russians. Right. If you take a look at the oligarchs, the private oligarchs in Russia, they have lost huge sums of money, huge, huge sums of money. But it hasn't really trickled down to the people that much, which is rather interesting. Then in the last 2 weeks, we've seen the price of oil be driven down again as Saudi Arabia keeps pumping oil like mad onto the global market. And this compounded with the tentative deal reached with Iran and the possibility of their oil reserves re-hitting the market. It's driven the price of oil down, and that's driven the ruble down, as it there's usually a pretty strong correlation between the two. So we've seen the ruble drop quite significantly in the past 2 weeks, I would say. And that has added to the stock market jitters here. But if you are walking around in Russia, that stock market problems, even the change in the ruble, it doesn't really matter that much, because the Russian economy seems to a large extent to have effectively removed itself from the West, so that unless you're actively taking a vacation in Europe or the United States, or investing in something that is actually made there, which isn't very much, then the ruble drop hasn't had a huge effect, and inflation hasn't really been much over 10%, I would say. Based on my shopping at the local grocery store here in Moscow, we haven't really seen a huge increase in prices. So life goes on here pretty much as normal. Of what I've seen, that there's less Russians taking vacations abroad, at least particularly in the West this year. That seems to be the biggest effect for most Russians, which actually only hurts Europe and the United States.
Right, that's right. You know, going to that point of the dichotomy, really, between the actual economy and the financial architecture, the superstructure over it, or the parallel structure, even if it's, I don't know if it's related to it enough to sit on top of it.
Yeah.
You see examples of that, as you describe, in Russia, and I'm guessing that that's also true in China.
Yes, at least as much in China as it is in Russia. More so, I would say, even than in the United States.
Right. You have, in terms of real economic, you know, basics in China, you have factories that are employed. You still have actual demand for many things among the Chinese population, a huge market, and a developing market still. And those are really the engines of growth under a capitalist economy.
Yes.
So even if they also suffer a devaluation of their currency and, you know, whatever other effects that has, and again, you have state ownership of pensions there as opposed to the kinds of mutual funds and, you know, private things that invest in the stock market, you don't see people's pensions being wiped out like you see happening here. And looking at, you know, your area is geopolitical strategy, that stuff. Looking at the end game, if there is a financial collapse again, you have all these political problems doing what they did in 2008 in the West. You almost had a rebellion among the population then for propping up the banks, record numbers of emails to Congress not to do it and all of that. Certainly the political will is even less now to go there. If they can't fix it, there's no real economic basics anymore in the United States. It doesn't have the capacity to manufacture most things. They're manufactured in China. What Russia did when it was sanctioned was turn inward and make the things that weren't available anymore. Like you had pointed out, Parmesan cheese, you had to buy domestic instead of imported from Italy, and it didn't really make much of a difference to you.
I'm not an affineur, okay? All right, but what I found was entirely possible for my fettuccine Alfredo.
But okay, so, I mean, here in the United States, we might be looking at, we haven't recovered in terms of the real economy here from 2008.
Yeah.
Unemployment is still...
That's a really 25%. Interesting number, to look at the unemployment, and we have to be careful when we take a look at unemployment, the way it's calculated in the U.S., because it drops people off the rolls and they just become structurally unemployed.
Right.
So the real unemployment in the United States is close to 15%, and significantly worse in some areas. Mm-hmm. Now we take a look at Russia, supposedly in the midst of a financial crisis, supposedly the world is collapsing around us. People are eating dogs and cats in the streets, evidently, from what I read in the Wall Street Journal, although I haven't seen it myself, not with my four dogs anyway. The unemployment rate in Russia is near historic lows, which is part of what leads to Russia's resilience in the face of this. Construction continues, maybe not quite at the breakneck pace it was, you know, say around 2008 before the crisis hit, but life continues here and employment continues.
So looking at that, if we end up with a situation where the government is either going to be forced to prop up the financial architecture yet again, and it's not going to solve the problem, by the way, with the problem being the unemployment, the problem being the fact that the people at the bottom that are supposed to buy everything don't have any money. Essentially, there was a class war in the United States. It's over. They won. And, you know, the question is now what next here? And so there's already... not even latent, you know, some serious political unrest over this. The political system is not responsive to it. I mean, the closest we're coming to that is Bernie Sanders. And yet there are going to be some even more politically unpopular moves without any remedy to the underlying problems facing people. And as conditions harden and there are more and more, there's more and more evidence of financial distress here, you're going to see more of it. And I'm wondering what the geopolitical implications of actual unrest developing in the United States are for Russia and the rest of the world.
Okay. I got to be honest with you. One of my favorite things to read in terms of speculative fiction that is, right, is truly Hugo Award level is speculation by some American politicians of the impending collapse, right, and disintegration of Russia into its component parts, or vice versa, some Russians equally right about the collapse and disintegration of the United States, right? You know, doing to unrest, ethnic tension, so on. And I got to be honest with you, I don't see either one of those situations happening in either country.
No, I'm not talking about that kind of a collapse. Yeah, I'm talking about where there's some serious political exigency that's presented to the political class here because of the potential for, you know, a situation maybe spinning out of hand due to the relatively poor condition facing a large portion of the population. That we're almost there now in terms, I mean, we have Donald Trump, for example, being one of the best that they can offer on the public stage. Do you think that that's going to make, I mean, we're seeing some evidence of it already, but do you think that there's a danger of that making the United States even more adventurous in order to distract people's attention from the problems that they face at home?
Okay. I think you touched on one of the real points there is this. We see people in the United States, on one hand, Donald Trump, who is an obvious clown, but supposedly has business credentials, although if you take a look at most of his businesses, they've gone bankrupt. Right. But we've got this populism, this right-wing populism of Donald Trump on one hand, and you've got what is identified, certainly not the left-wing populism of Bernie Sanders, who is technically a socialist, right? He's to the left of just about everyone in the U.S. Democratic Party, and not technically a member of the party. Now, that repeats a trend that we see much stronger in Europe, in France, in the UK, in the Netherlands, and other countries where people are leaving the centrist parties, right and left, for parties on the fringes because what they've seen a neoliberal centralization of politics and power that is not meeting their interests. I think it's much, much stronger in Europe than it is in the United States. But this election, I think for the first time, we're really, even though it's only in the primaries, and I think we both know that neither Bernie Sanders or Donald Trump is going to be the respective candidates of their party. But still, we see a little beginnings of it, a little symptom in people turning immediately on either the right or the left to outside candidates like Sanders and like Trump.
You have, meanwhile, the mainstays of the neoliberal construct, Hillary Clinton, Jeb Bush, a host of others in the Republican Party with, you know, their own idiosyncratic, crazy points. Do you think that this tug to the fringes will impact not just their rhetoric, we've seen a little bit of that, but also the actual policies, and are there any international geopolitical likely or possible impacts from that?
No, I don't think so. I think, I mean, you'll domestically, of course, we don't even know if Hillary Clinton's going to survive as a candidate right now. This Benghazi scandal, which is a completely artificial scandal from the real Libya scandal of overthrowing the Libyan government. Right. But it's still being incredibly damaging to her. And both, as I understand it, both Biden and Gore are considering throwing their hats in the race right now. Biden has nearly entered the race. That's certainly going to, cause some both the right and the left will have to swing a little bit to the right or left to counter during the primaries. But that's a normal process. I think the American people are going to have to suffer much, much more. We're going to have to see the middle class shrink much, much more into the lower class, as we saw in 2008, put to a much higher degree before we'll see some real division from the centrist candidates in the respective parties, like we're seeing in Europe. It could come, but the American people are going to have to suffer a lot more for it. Foreign policy wise, the foreign policy elite in the United States is really fairly locked when it comes to important issues. We see a little bit of division on issues like Israel and Iran, but even then, you know, it has to be couched in certain terms and so on. Obama's laid a lot on the line with this Iran deal. It's expected that any Democratic front runner will adopt the same policy, and it's expected that every Republican will at least rhetorically oppose it. So I think that perhaps is the biggest. But when it comes to China, when it comes to Russia, when it comes to things like the militarization of Africa, the games that the U.S. is playing in the Middle East, I don't think whether the difference between a Jeb Bush and a Hillary Clinton or even a Donald Trump and a Bernie Sanders is really going to matter that much.
How about finally just one spot that has, you know, is fraught with danger, Ukraine? In the context that we've been discussing earlier, is there danger because they have to find some, well, because, you know, more or less reckless rhetoric is holding sway under the present conditions in the United States? Is it possible that policy will be driven there by, say, the next president, and there will be some sort of U.S. intervention in the event that Russia intervenes?
Yeah, okay. I mean, that is you know, the real danger. If Russia feels they have to intervene either to protect their own interests or to protect a, you know, whole-scale slaughter in Donetsk or Lugansk or both, will NATO react? Okay, and in any normal day of the week, you're going to say no, you know, you won't have a direct confrontation. NATO will simply increase military aid, increase this, do more of the same. But they won't go to town in Ukraine against Russia, something that could lead directly to a nuclear confrontation. I say that to myself. And then you have to take a look back to the events of 2008, the August War, with the Georgian attempt to seize the enclaves of South Ossetia and Abkhazia. And we see that in the White House, there was a serious, this is from leaked, the memoirs of members of the Bush administration. They have been very open that there was a conversation in the White House about attacking Russian forces coming through the Rocky Tunnel into South Ossetia in order to cut them off and cut off the Rocky Tunnel. That would have been U.S. Jets firing on Russian troops. There was a serious conversation in the White House about that. Dick Cheney supported the idea, as did a number of other neocons. It was actually evidently talked down by Bush himself. Wow. So that should scare you. That should scare everyone. And who knows? Hillary Clinton is a hawk, okay? And certainly, we could see any one of a number of Republicans be both, a warmonger or stupid or both, be it Trump or Bush or whoever. So it's a very scary situation. There are more military drills, Russia and NATO back and forth, Russia and China naval drills. There's so much drilling going on right now. So many massive conventional forces laid flat out on the line against each other. The room for mistakes and misunderstanding and escalation is dangerous, people. It's dangerous. We're talking Cuban Missile Crisis, dangerous, and we're not out of it yet.
Okay, Mark Sloboda, thank you very much. A pleasure as always.
Thanks for having me, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.